Hello and welcome to DNA Today. I'm your host, Kira Janine. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. The show is packed with news stories, lessons, interviews, all to keep you updated and educated on the ever-changing world of genetics. And I want to remind everybody, I'm still broadcasting throughout winter break, so tune in Mondays at 1 p.m. And if you can't listen live, you can go to dnapodcast.com, and everything is on there to listen to. For this episode, I've got genetics news for you, and it's chock full of it. So first, news story is about research on how genetics can affect the brain and therefore behavior. Another study has been published regarding the mechanism that regulates dopamine levels in the brain. Dopamine is kind of one of those neurotransmitters that's linked to happiness, and we'll get to all that. And those regulation of dopamine levels all come down to one gene, which is really interesting. Our last news story is about DNA traveling into space, which, I mean, doesn't get much cooler than that, right? So loads of interesting, cool news stories, so stay tuned. And let's start out with the first one. So can people be genetically predisposed to antisocial behavior? This is something that sounds a little weird, that you can be antisocial because of your genes. Now, Shyla Hodgins of University of Montreal sought out to explore this concept to see if both positive and negative experiences influence how gene variants affect the brain and therefore behavior. Now, Hodgins and her colleagues published a study on December 11th, 2014, so just a couple weeks ago, and this was in the International Journal of Neuropsychopharmacology. Now, this research took place in Sweden, in Västmanland, and all of the 17 and 18-year-old kids in this county were asked to take part in this study, and 1,337 did, so they got quite a lot of kids, and all of this 17, 18-years-old kind of bracket. And for this study, these teenagers answered anonymous questionnaires that asked them to comment on their personal experience with various things, delinquency, family conflict, experiences of sexual abuse, and the quality of their relationship with their parents. These kind of four main factors that the research focused on, along with their DNA. They also provided their DNA via a saliva sample, which is probably the easiest way. Now, Hodgins had a lot of quotes and comments on this, so I want to share them with you because coming from her, obviously, that's a very, very expert opinion here. So she said, quote, "Evidence is accumulating to show that effects of variants of many genes that are common in the population depend on environmental factors. Further, these genetic variants affect each other. We conducted a study to determine whether juvenile offending was associated with interactions between three common genetic variants and positive and negative experiences." So she's really looking at three common genetic variances and the environment, if it's positive or negative experiences that the person's experiencing, and the combination of all these things to see what's happening in the behavior of the kid. So again, the research focused on three common gene variants, MAOA, BDNF, and 5-HTTLPR. So these are the three types. The three gene variants. So the first gene is MAOA, which stands for monoamine oxidase A. And this gene encodes for a protein, particularly an enzyme. Recall, an enzyme is a protein that's a catalyst for biological reaction. So it makes a reaction happen. It makes it happen faster than it normally would without this enzyme. It's the catalyst of the reaction. So this enzyme, MAOA, functions to inactivate serotonin and dopamine and other neurotransmitters. So some neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine are linked to contribute to happiness and kind of is controlling our happiness depending on how much there is and if it's, you know, being passed around in these neurotransmitters. Now, the more active MAO gene is, the more the neurotransmitters are broken down. So this enzyme is breaking down these neurotransmitters. So if there's a lot of this enzyme, and, you know, if the gene is turned on, there's a lot of this enzyme being produced, then the neurotransmitter is going to be broken down. There's going to be less that are fully operational. And so therefore, behaviors or moods associated with these neurotransmitters are affected. Another quote from Hodgins, about 25% of Caucasian men carry the less active variant of MAOA. Among them, those who experienced physical abuse in childhood are more likely than those who were not abused to display serious antisocial behavior from childhood through adulthood. Among females, it is the high active variant of the MAOA gene that interacts with adversity in childhood to increase the likelihood of antisocial behavior. So if you have a more active gene producing more of the enzyme, more of the neurotransmitter is going to be broken down. Now, if it's less active, that means the neurotransmitters are kind of staying in place more functional and not messed with. The enzyme is really messing with these neurotransmitters. So the second gene is BDNF, and this is the one that stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Now, this gene regulates neuronal plasticity. Now, what is neuronal plasticity? Because that's not really a common thing, right? So it's the brain's ability to change neural pathways and synapses. Synapses are kind of the connection between neurotransmitters. So it's changing kind of the brain's map of how it interacts with these neurotransmitters. And this can cause changes in behavior, environment, or it's due to changes in behavior, environment, neural processes, thinking, emotions, as well as changes resulting from bodily injury. So a lot of things can affect how the body, or how the brain, rather, is having these neural pathways and how they get reconnected if they are compromised to begin with. Hodden shared a quote, "The low expressing variants of BDNF are carried by approximately 30% of individuals, and some previous studies have shown that this variant was associated with aggressive behavior if carriers were exposed to aggressive peers." So it's kind of like this gene is predisposing this, you know, these individuals to have aggressive behavior. So you kind of already have this kind of trigger to have aggressive behavior. But once you're, you know, introduced to it, and if peers have it, or maybe even parents, then that's when it can kind of come out. So you're predisposed to it, kind of like drinking. If you're in your genetics, if you are predisposed to be an alcoholic and you then start drinking, then you may become an alcoholic. Whereas if you were predisposed to it but don't drink, that doesn't mean you're going to be an alcoholic, because you would have to drink and be exposed to that. So the same thing with aggressive behaviors is that if you are predisposed in your genetics to be aggressive, you still have to, you know, see aggressive behavior being modeled in order to, you know, express that behavior yourself. She has another quote. The third gene was studied was the serotonin transporter 5-HTTLPR. And the low active variant of this gene is carried by approximately 20% of individuals. Among carriers of this low active variant, those exposed to adversity in childhood are more likely than those who are not display antisocial and aggressive behavior. So if you have a low active of this gene, then you are more likely to not display antisocial and aggressive behavior. So this one, if you have a low level of it, then it's lower aggressive behavior and antisocial behavior. She says, again, we found that the three genetic variants interacted with each other and with family conflict and sexual abuse to increase the likelihood of delinquency, and with positive parent-child relationships to decrease the risk of delinquency. So these three gene variants interacting with each other, also with experiences in people's environment, if it is negative experiences, then it's more likely that these individuals are going to increase their likelihood of delinquency, as she says. But if there's positive parent relationships with the children and other positive things in their environment that they're exposed to, it decreases the risk of delinquency. But it's going back to those genes, and it's the combination of these two forces coming together of your genes and your environment, nature, nurture, right, that these behaviors might persist. She goes on to say, among carriers of the low active variants of all three genes, those exposed to family conflict or sexual abuse or both reported high levels of delinquency, with those that reported a positive and warm relationship with their other parents reported little or no delinquency. So it's very important, that child-parent relationship and, you know, that nature aspect, to see if these behaviors persist or not. So therefore, the bottom line is that the same genetic variants that are associated with high and low levels of delinquency depend on what kind of exposure they have, either negative or positive environments. Maybe that negative relationship with a parent, or, you know, exposed to negative behaviors of peers. So a lot of different factors can go into this, and it really makes a huge effect. And she kind of sums up saying, these findings add to those from other studies to show that genes affect the brain and thereby behavior by altering sensitivity to the environment. So very interesting that our behavior can be caused by not only our environment, but also our genes. It's really that nature and nurture. They always say nature versus nurture, but it's kind of hand in hand. They kind of work together to, you know, give the individual their behavior. Our next news story, researchers have uncovered a mechanism regulating dopamine levels in the brain, and it all comes down to one gene, which this is what the study is, you know, supporting and everything, and nothing is science is 100%, but this is what this study is supporting, that the regulation of dopamine levels in the brain is coming down to only one gene. You think about how many genes we have in our body, and this dopamine is so important for happiness, and it's all being regulated by one gene. And as stated earlier, dopamine is a neurotransmitter that contributes to how happy we feel. Now, this study was led by Dr. Jacques Drouin in Montreal, with contributions by Dr. Roy Fisher from the Department of Pharmacology at the University of Iowa, Carver College of Medicine. And the research is published online by scientific journal PLOS Genetics. If you're interested in reading it, you can definitely go check that out. And they developed a mechanism to regulate dopamine levels in the brain. So let's see kind of how they went about this, how they did this, how they know they were successful in, you know, looking at the regulation of the dopamine levels. So as many research studies do, they utilize mice. And I've talked about it before on the show that Jackson Laboratory is like the capital of the world for mice. They have, I believe, like thousands of different strains of mice, and you can like order them there, and it's really cool. So definitely you can check out jax.com, I think it is. I'm not sure. But if you type in Jack's Lab, it'll definitely come up on Google. But yeah, it's really interesting to see how much they really have on there, and how there are so many different types of mice. You might think, oh, there's a couple, whatever, but really there's like thousands. So very interesting. But this study utilized mice that had Parkinson's disease. And you might ask, okay, why are they looking at Parkinson's disease? Why this over just a healthy, normal mouse? And this is because when someone is affected by Parkinson's disease, their neurons in their brain are not operating as smoothly. So the researchers looked closely at the dopaminergic neurons in the midbrain. And these are neurons that use dopamine to communicate. And as stated earlier, dopamine is a neurotransmitter that contributes to how happy we feel. So how are the researchers able to look at the dopamine levels? Well, they use this technology called gene expression profiling. And this is a method to measure the activity of thousands of genes. So the expression level, all right, is gene A expressing a lot? Is it a little bit? You know, looking at the different levels of, you know, thousands and thousands of genes. So the researchers were able to pinpoint the excess of dopamine production to one gene called RGS6. And what happens is the RGS6 causes too much dopamine to be produced, and the dopamine kind of clogs the neuron. It can't, these little neurotransmitters aren't able to transmit to the next neuron because it kind of gets clogged in one spot. Dr. Drouin shared, we identified the RGS6 gene for its restricted expression of dopaminergic neurons, and we have previously shown that this gene is itself controlled by a transcription factor called PTIX3, which plays an important role in the survival of these neurons. And so basically, he's saying that this transcription factor is controlling the amount of expression of the gene, RGS6. And when RGS6 is activated, then it causes too much dopamine to be produced, and then that neuron gets clogged up. Now, the transcription factor is playing a role in how much of the expression is happening. And so Dr. Drouin also shares, throughout our study, we discovered a defective RGS6 gene causes the death of these neurons. So more specifically, we found when we remove the RGS6 gene, this relieves a break in excessive dopamine signaling. And as a result, excess free dopamine accumulation that causes cellular stress, which in turn causes the neurons to die. All right, so let me repeat that. As a result, excess free dopamine accumulation causes cellular stress, which in turn causes the neurons to die. Our work thus indicates that RGS6 could be a new target for the development of drugs against Parkinson's disease. And for those that aren't completely familiar with Parkinson's disease, you may have heard of it before. It's a very serious progressive disease that affects the nervous system and therefore movement. So being a progressive disease means that the disease gets worse over time. The symptoms become more serious. There's no cure, but there are some medications that can help ease symptoms and kind of allow the person to live a better quality of life. And symptoms often begin on one side of your body, which is kind of unique to this disease. That doesn't happen in a lot of diseases. And usually it remains worse on that one side where it kind of started, even after symptoms begin to affect both sides. And symptoms, there's a long list. They include tremors, slow movement, which is called bradykinesia, rigid muscles, impaired posture and balance, loss of automatic movements, speech and writing changes. And the disorder is also commonly causes stiffness or slowing of movement. So it really is, it affects the nervous system. So your nervous system kind of allows you to have your whole body kind of communicating with each other. And so because of this, it really impacts your movement and your ability to decide, oh, I want to do this. You know, your automatic movements and, you know, your all of that kind of stuff. So it really is affecting, and it's a very, very serious disease, and it's progressive. So it gets worse over time, that it starts out with a few symptoms, and, you know, over time, the individual can become much worse. So very sad disease, but this is a great news story because it's highlighting that, you know, this one gene is causing the dopamine different levels being expressed. So if this gene can be more regulated, then there can be a healthy and good amount of dopamine and maybe even Parkinson's disease. This can be a treatment or, I mean, even cure for Parkinson's disease. So the more we learn about how genes are relating to diseases and symptoms and what exactly they're doing, then we can take it to the next step and try and regulate those genes so that we can kind of eliminate symptoms and eliminate diseases that say, oh, you have this? Ah, here's this medication. It'll regulate this gene. There you go. You're all set. You're all healthy now. So obviously that's an ideal situation that there's drugs to be able to be developed that kind of are so specific in the way that they attack different genes and things. So, but you know, the more information we have, the better, and the more drugs we can create and different other treatment techniques and all of that. So it's very exciting to see that, you know, this is persisting. We can learn more about this and really understand what's going on. So our next news story, I think this is definitely the coolest, maybe one of the like the cooler stories that I've talked about on here. And DNA can survive re-entry from space. And this is kind of mind-blowing. So DNA was attached to a rocket and survived a short space flight and later passed on their biological instructions. So it didn't get destroyed. It was able to continue functioning, like going out of the Earth and back in to the atmosphere. And so the DNA was able to withstand the extreme heat and pressure going through the Earth's atmosphere. And Swiss and German scientists teamed up to put DNA on the exterior of their spaceship. So some of the DNA on the spaceship survived and was able to successfully pass on its genetic information. And this is a great indication that foreign DNA from space may have entered Earth's orbit years and years ago, the start of life on Earth, once it arrived and started producing that. It could have, you know, been on a meteor and went down through Earth's atmosphere and persisted living on Earth. Now, the spaceship exited the Earth's orbit and then re-entered. The whole journey was only a mere 13 minutes, which is just kind of crazy. In my mind, when I was reading this, I was like, oh, it must have been weeks or something that, you know, they went up there, came back, whatever. But it was only 13 minutes. So it's like when you think about it, you get in the car, you go somewhere 13 minutes, like that's how long that they were out there. So unfortunately, the spaceship doesn't completely show what a meteor would have been like entering the Earth's atmosphere, as a meteor would go like much faster and hotter, and so the conditions would be a little bit more extreme, but it's definitely the best experiment we have so far to see that DNA is able to survive the entry and exit into the Earth's atmosphere. So temperatures on the exterior of the rocket reached as high as 115.4 degrees Celsius. So this isn't Fahrenheit, it's Celsius. Remember that water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. So kind of putting that in perspective. So this is during liftoff and 128.3 degrees Celsius during atmospheric re-entry back into the Earth when they're coming back home. So the findings are, quote, a stop on the way to understanding what the limits are for DNA's survival. And research scientist Christopher Carr of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who was not involved in the work but called the results provocative. He was just commenting on this new research that he was reading about. And the next steps, he shares, would be to further pin down what temperature and pressure would ultimately kill the DNA. And then we could probably see how fast meteors go and what temperature they are when they enter the Earth. And then we could say, hey, if meteors entered the Earth, you know, how many years ago, then DNA could have survived in those circumstances. And maybe that's how life on Earth started. So this is definitely very exciting. And for this experiment, the DNA was in plasmid form. So plasmid is like a circular piece of DNA that cannot function unless it maintains this circular structure. Usually DNA, it's that double helix, and it's wrapped around histone proteins, and histone proteins are wrapped around each other to be in chromosomes, and that's in its most condensed state. But plasmids are just a circular piece of DNA, so very different. And the plasmids were put into indents of screw heads on the spaceship. So right on the exterior in the screw heads, which gives it a little bit more protection. But you think about a meteor, it could be in a little, you know, little crook nanny, whatever in there. And so how do they know that the plasmids were intact? I mean, it's on a screw head. How are you going to say, yep, that worked, that's fine? Well, they were able to put them under a microscope to see the structure was fine. But they're also able to insert the plasmid into cells, E. coli to be more specific. And these E. coli took up the plasmid successfully. What happens is that plasmids can be inserted into cells. And once they do that, they can express the genes in that cell that are in the plasmid. So we know that it was successfully put in because the former non-resistant against antibiotics E. coli, that if you put antibiotics with this E. coli, the E. coli would have died. But now with this new plasmid, the E. coli was able to survive with the presence of antibiotics, which means that the plasmid was correctly inserted and functional within the E. coli. Because when they tried that again, after they tried to put the plasmid in the E. coli, when the E. coli was exposed to antibiotics, it proliferated. It was fine. It kept growing and everything. So we knew that the plasmid, not only survived in structure and maintaining its structure, but also was able to continue its functioning, which is really exciting to see that this is actually something that DNA can withstand. And DNA is probably, I mean, I'm very biased, my show is about DNA, but it is the coolest molecule because you think about how complex it is, but yet it kind of has a simplistic design to be able to, you know, replicate itself so quickly and be expressing genes and whatnot. And it's only made up of like four letters. I think our alphabet has 26. DNA's alphabet only has four letters. So it's really like the coolest molecule out there, but just had to nerd out for a moment. But this is the first hardcore evidence that DNA can survive in space. And there's been previous studies on the survival of other microbes living like a year and a half in space. But this is the first that DNA can survive in space, and not only just survive up in space, but surviving going out of the Earth's atmosphere and back in, which is like, you know, a really hard journey for a little molecule like DNA. And the same experiment using bacteria and fungi did not find success in bacteria and fungi living through the exit and re-entry into Earth's atmosphere. Some people argue that this is not true, that bacteria survived on the Columbia spaceship, but that's kind of controversial. There's really no hardcore evidence on this. And if you can prove me wrong, email me. I'd love to hear that. But from what I understand, it seems that it's not true, but some people argue it is. But that's kind of up in the air. But Carr says that the new study gets us thinking what controlled experiments we should do to explore the limit for life and what the limit is for DNA. What extreme conditions can DNA stand? At what point does DNA break down? I mean, obviously, we break down DNA in the lab, but in environments outside of the lab, you know, in the world, in space, what can DNA withstand? And withstand meaning that how can they keep the DNA to keep producing and be fine and reproduce and everything, and just being able to fully function, that its functions is not at all affected. So if you're interested in reading the study yourself, you can check it out in PLOS1, and you can just Google DNA can survive reentry from space, and I'm sure it's going to come right up. This news story was from Scientific America, but it was just an article on it that I was looking at. Well, that wraps up today's episode of DNA Today. You can tune in next week, Monday at 1 p.m. on WHUS.org or 91.7 FM to learn more about genetics. I am broadcasting through winter break, so you can keep tuning in Mondays at 1 p.m. I will always be broadcasting. DNApodcast.com is another great website. It's full of content, including all episodes I've broadcast on WHUS, as well as other mini lessons. If you get behind all the episodes, that's years ago, I used to put little lessons on there, and there's even some bioethical debates on there. Lots of resources to expand your genetic knowledge from just this half hour every week that you can look at the University of Utah and lots of different links. Even there's a crash course of biology from Hank Green, and he's great. He explains things very fast. You have to watch the video multiple times, but he's a great resource. Another one to throw out there is Bozeman's Science. I don't know how much genetic stuff he has, but if you're interested in biology, he has fantastic videos that got me through AP Bio. So definitely check all that stuff out. It's all on the website, dnapodcast.com. If you're interested, you could also follow on Twitter at DNA Podcast. Follow me on Twitter at KiraDineEen. That's at Kira Dineen on Twitter. And I promise I will be tweeting more. If you have any questions you want answered on air, shoot me an email at info@dnapodcast.com. I really like getting your emails. I like kind of that challenge of, oh, I have this idea. Is this right? Can you research this? It kind of puts my focus on something that instead of me just choosing whatever I want to talk about, it's good to get suggestions from the listeners. And even if you're just like, hey, I like the show, or hey, I hate the show, you should do this instead. Feedback is always very welcome. And it's very helpful. You know, especially the criticism and kind of helpful criticism so I can get better. But again, I'm broadcasting through winter breaks. Continue listening Monday at 1 p.m. Thanks for listening and join me next week again, Monday 1 p.m., to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.